We began a study of Galatians 2:20 some 2 or 3 weeks ago, I guess. And as I've pondered the information in this verse and realized where it sits in terms of the theology of the New Testament, I have struggled with some of the things that Paul says because of the way he says them. We've been pondering the mystery of the meaning of being indwelt by the Spirit of Christ in terms of what the results will be. Our problem is that the concept is couched in the context of two apostles, both indwelt by Christ, both would say, Christ lives in me. But in our context, they're at serious doctrinal odds with one another at the level of what's coming out of their bodies. And on the one hand, we recognize that the reality of Christ actually dwelling in our bodies is a matter of huge import in terms of implications. But on the other hand, we recognize that the reality of an apostle who participates in that reality of Christ dwelling in his body in some way, but is also a practical apostate, that's a matter of great consternation. So we have Paul on the one side saying, Christ dwells in me, and the life that I now live, I live by faith. We're going to get into that this evening. But on the other hand, we have another apostle, Cephas, who is also indwelt by the same Christ, and his behavior is apostate in practical terms. He's denying the gospel in practical expression out of his body. He's not necessarily doctrinally apostate, but his behavior is, because Paul is saying he's acting the hypocrite, and the issue is whether the gospel will remain with you or not. So it's very fundamental. The issue in this text is this. There is a balloon of ecstasy that is created by the declaration that God's Spirit actually dwells in our bodies. It is his indwelling presence that produces whatever joy we have, whatever love we have, whatever peace we have, whatever long-suffering and gentleness and faithfulness and meekness and all, whatever those characteristics we actually enjoy, come right off of him. It's his fruit and it's his presence in us that create that. So I call it a balloon of ecstasy. I mean, the high points of ecstatic joy are created by the fact that the Spirit of God dwells in our bodies. But that balloon is punctured by the reality in our text of Cephas in his practical denial of the gospel itself by withdrawing his fellowship from the Gentiles because they hadn't been circumcised and they didn't subscribe to keeping the law of Moses. And in effect, his withdrawal was a statement, you're not good enough to fellowship with me. And the fact that you're not good enough is a reality between you and God. Because that's the only way anybody's not good enough to fellowship with somebody else, is if they're not good enough to fellowship with God. So it's very clear that his withdrawal from them was a declaration that they hadn't really trusted the gospel the proper way. And that was complete hypocrisy. Paul says that he knew better, the end of verse 11. That he stood condemned, we told you when we were studying that. That actually means he knew better. But in his behavior, fear-driven behavior, he was blowing up the gospel. And when that happens, what happens to the Christ who's dwelling in him? This intrusion of Peter's practical apostasy out of fear while Christ is dwelling in his body is confronted by Paul, who has Christ dwelling in his body too, in our text. And it creates a tension for us. Because we would think that if the Spirit of God is dwelling in our bodies, we could anticipate some pretty phenomenal things. But Peter's example says, well, maybe not. And then, in connection to the, well, maybe not, there is also this. And that is the intrusion of our own reality as believers, who often blunder badly. And that reality, the reminder to us of our own false steps and our own blundering around, that steps up to the plate. And to mix metaphors, it pretty much deflates the balloon. On the one hand, you have this phenomenal doctrinal declaration that ought to lead to some phenomenal things, And then on the other hand, you have that phenomenal doctrinal declaration just completely eroded by the behavior of an apostle. And his behavior is not that different from ours on occasion, so we have to admit, well, maybe this whole thing is oversold. Does the teaching of the basic methodology of the Christian life found in Paul's statements here in Galatians 2 have any genuine reality in it? Is this just smoke and mirrors, a politician's promise of progress toward something higher when the reality is every day it gets worse? Is that what we're really dealing with? Well, before we cast in the towel, I want to make sure we understand what Paul actually said. You really ought not to reject something until you clearly understand exactly what you're rejecting. You ought not to be overwhelmed by the doubts that are created by the stuff until you understand exactly what it is you're doubting. And that only that means you got to understand what's going on. So, I'm still working on another study in this verse, which, Lord willing, we'll get to next week. So we're not going to cover everything this evening, but I do want to try to start out by making some things as clear as we can, because I really do believe that a lot of times the confusion's in our head because we really don't look at the details enough to understand what's going on. So I'm just going to start like this. The most clear doctrinal reality in this context consists of about three things. One of them is, obviously, the context says this, obviously, the presence of the Spirit of Christ in a person's body does not guarantee that person's behavior will be legitimate. That's got to be obvious from our text. Either Paul was the only one in whom the Spirit of God dwelt, and this is not a general Christian truth, or Cephas was indwelt by the same Spirit of Christ that Paul was, but Cephas and Paul's behavior was different from night and day in this context. And that's got to mean this, that the presence of the Spirit in us doesn't guarantee that our behavior will be legitimate. Cephas stands out in the New Testament on multiple occasions as a potent example of how easy it is to thwart the indwelling Spirit of Christ in what He would produce in our bodies, what He would desire to produce out of our bodies. Cephas simply stands as an example. He shows up multiple times. I'm not ignoring the fact that Cephas was also a classic example of the positive side of this occasionally too. He's the guy who preached the Pentecost sermon that won 3,000 people to Jesus. He's the guy that bubbled to the surface of the church in Jerusalem, as Paul calls him in this text, the apostle to the circumcision. He's the guy who God used to walk down the street and wherever his shadow fell on people who were ill, they got well. I mean, you know, it was like one of these ball game wave things, you know? When his shadow went over, up they came. Because they were being healed spontaneously, miraculously, powerfully. This is Peter, or Cephas. But, given that, he still stands out on occasion as a clear example, a potent example, of how easy it is to thwart the Spirit of Christ who dwells in our bodies. And in the face of that, Paul really cannot guarantee anything. He can't offer us guarantees in the face of this indisputable failure. He can't say that because Christ dwells in your body will produce godliness. He can't guarantee that. So that ought to be clear. I mean, the context, that ought to be indisputable among thinking, cooperative people. On the other hand, though, this has also got to be as clear as that, and that is this, that the presence of the Spirit of Christ in a person's body does offer the possibility of an extraordinary production out of that body. There's no guarantee, but there is a possibility of some extraordinary things. And let me say this about extraordinary things. They really are extraordinary things. The gifts of the Spirit, without exception, all of the gifts that are listed, and I assume from that the gifts that are not listed are just like them, and that is this. You can't do them without the Spirit. And that makes them extraordinary. Now, they may look a little ordinary after they've been done several times, because everything gets ordinary after you get exposed to it enough. But that doesn't mean it's not extraordinary anymore. It just means you got used to it. But the fact is, the presence of the Spirit in a person's body offers the possibility of an extraordinary production of godly behavior out of that body. Paul's theology, his doctrine, and the very letters of this letter, and you have the text in front of you, the letters of his letter, this is verse 20, to the jot and tittle level, or in the Greek it would probably be the iota subscript and the iota, because those are the smallest letter and the smallest form of a letter in the Greek language, absolutely accurate. We have an inerrant, no mistake, revelation from God through Paul because the Spirit of God dwelt in his body. So, extraordinary production. Paul the Apostle wrote most of the New Testament. We have our New Testament because the Spirit of Christ dwelt in Paul's body. It's an extraordinary production. It's an inerrant, infallible, no mistake revelation from God because the Spirit of God dwelt in a guy's body. So when we say that the presence of the Spirit offers the possibility, I'm saying this context says that's got to be true. This is one of the overarching realities of our context. It's got to be true, because if Paul's argument with Cephas in verses 11 through 21 was not inerrant, then Paul didn't have anything to say to Peter at all. I mean, if Paul can't give Peter a better doctrinal understanding by more accurate words, then just shut up, Paul. Let Peter just be his fearful, foolish self, and you just be your, you know, whatever you are, and we'll all just go about our rat killing, and we'll get along as best we can, and we'll split when we can't, and there's nothing real here. But if Paul's writing is inspired, authoritative, doctrinal reality, then the possibility of extraordinary something coming out of our bodies because the Spirit of God dwells in our bodies is at least there. The possibility's there. And I want you to remember that Cephas could offer no rebuttal at any point at what Paul said. Verses 6 of chapter 2 and verse 9 of chapter 2 actually tell us that they added nothing to my gospel. Nothing. And they extended the right hand of fellowship to me. And this included Cephas. So he could offer no rebuttal. What Paul said in verse 11 through 21, no rebuttal, no correction, no alteration, no modification of any kind. They added nothing. And from our perspective, 2,000 years later, we have the longer view of what Paul wrote in the New Testament. And the longer view is jot and tittle accuracy. It's the most profound wisdom you'll find in this world, because it's not of this world. This is the wisdom of God written by a man in whom the Spirit of God dwelt. So that's the second thing that's very clear. I don't think anybody can really argue from this context that the Spirit of Christ in a person's body doesn't guarantee legitimate behavior, but it does offer the possibility of extraordinary godly behavior. Thirdly, I believe that there is a contextual mandate for the notion that the displeasure of the Christ dwelling in Cephas, when Cephas pulled his hypocritical blunder by fear, he wounded and displeased the Spirit of Christ dwelling in him, in his body. Christ was displeased with that. The Spirit of Christ in him was not happy. And that displeasure was addressed by the Spirit of Christ dwelling in Paul's body. And the Spirit of Christ in Paul, confronting Cephas, addressed the displeasure of Christ with Cephas, and was an enormous demonstration of grace to Cephas, because it pulled him back from the brink of disaster. Because Paul said in verse 5 of chapter 2 that the gospel was at stake, and Peter's behavior was threatening to undercut it. So that would have been an unmitigated disaster. If Peter's behavioral presentation of the gospel had been allowed to stand, it would have trumped the gospel. The gospel would have died. It wouldn't have been available to us if Peter had been allowed to go forward with this. So why Paul said, I'm going to speak up here in front of everybody, and then I'm, you know, confront him in front of everybody. Well, the reason is because the Spirit of Christ in Paul wanted to salvage Cephas's ministry and life. He jerked him back from the brink of disaster by confronting his fear and saying, stop! It's like running into a brick wall. You're glad that brick wall's there when you look over the top and find out there's a 1,000-foot drop. And you almost went over it. But somebody stopped you. Well, this is the issue here. It's a very gracious act on the part of the Spirit of Christ in respect to Cephas. But he wasn't able, and I'm not minimizing the potency of the Spirit of God when I say that he wasn't able to do something. But the fact is, Peter had thwarted him internally. So God had to use another believer to address him externally so that he could confront him. That's a very gracious thing, but it's also a potent illustration of how critical the New Testament doctrine of the function of the current body of Christ, which is you and me, is. The Bible says that God did not give Christ his spirit by measure, but he did to us. We all have a measure. And sometimes the measure that we have isn't sufficient to keep us from doing some dumb something. And that's why the measure of Christ in you is designed to address the measure of Christ in me when I fall. It's your privilege to let the voice of God speak through you to my fault in order to minister grace to me. Same thing true with me. It's my privilege to be an instrument of God to speak the truth to somebody else that's not got the truth figured out yet, in order to help them step back from the brink of disaster that they're pushing toward. So I think these are expressions of the most clear doctrinal reality in the context. The Spirit of Christ dwelling in the body does not guarantee that the person's behavior will be legitimate, but it does offer the possibility of some remarkable stuff, and a part of that remarkable stuff will be the manifestation of the grace of Christ to other believers by other believers. That's why Hebrews 10:24 says we ought to get together and stimulate one another to love and good deeds. Because it's the Spirit of Jesus in me that's going to address your situation so that the Spirit of Jesus in you can get a better grip on your life. And it's the Spirit of Jesus in you that addresses me in such a way that the Spirit of Jesus in me can get a better grip on my life. Because out of these bodies should be made manifest the character and glory of our Savior. That's only a possibility. Upon what does the possibility rest? Well, that brings us to the second major point of our study, and that's the most unclear doctrinal reality. The most clear we've tried to make clear. But what's the most unclear part? Well, when it boils right down to it, the most unclear part is how in the world do I get out of the way so that the Spirit of Jesus in me can have access to my body to use it the way he wants to? Isn't that the most unclear thing? I run into this constantly, not only in my own heart, but in the lives and hearts of other believers. I just ask this simple question. How do you walk by the Spirit? And you get this look. Oh, are you going to try to force me to put that in words? The most unclear part is that Paul declares his doctrine in words that are precise to the jot and tittle level, but they are sufficiently contrary to human understanding that even our translators have regularly stumbled in trying to render his meaning. And that's why I handed you the sheet that I did to start the class off. In theory and practice, it's impossible to render a meaning that you don't know is there, that you can't understand. I mean, if you don't understand the meaning that's there, you cannot communicate it. And that's the translator's job, is to communicate the meaning of the text. Well, if the translator doesn't understand it, he can't. Okay? You can't. If you don't understand it, you can't communicate it. Somebody said it in a humorous way like this. Mist in the pulpit is fog in the pew. If there's confusion in the communicator, the communicated to, those who hear it, it'll even be worse for them because they won't have the foggiest idea what he's talking about. Because he doesn't have a clear idea either. So in terms of the jot and tittle accuracy of what Paul wrote, unless the translators understood the concept, they couldn't render it faithfully. And a careful comparison between the text Paul wrote and the translations that we have is instructive. And that's why I handed this thing. I want you to consider some of the problems that we have in our text. You see this little word here that's got the, I don't know if you can see the circle, but the word kind of looks like technically this is a delta and an epsilon. That in English is DE. Okay, so most of you have been exposed to enough Greek letters in the Phi Beta Kappa thing and all that to recognize that this is a delta. We use it, delta force, and we use the term delta all the time. But that's a D. This is an E. It's duh. Well, duh in Greek is a low-grade adversative. Picture something in your mind for me a minute. Picture a stream of water. And I'm going to tell you some things about it, and then I want you to tell me how the stream flows. The stream that you're observing has an unimpeded bed of sand, and the water is flowing over this smooth, sandy bottom. How is the water flowing? Yeah, it's just tranquil flow. Okay, let's suppose that somebody doesn't like that, so they go out and they dump 6 or 8 boulders into the stream. Now how's it flowing? Yeah, it's still flowing, but there's these interruptions. And now the thing is not smooth and flowing easily. It's still going forward, but it's bouncing around and it's running into obstacles and stuff. But what if somebody dumps a whole truckload of stuff in there? What do you got then? Rapids. I went too far. I got him up to the dam level. But I was really thinking only in terms of violent rapids where the water's in a turmoil and everything, but it's still flowing. Okay, now I'll give you that illustration because this is a rock in the flow. It's called an adversative because there's something adverse in the flow of the thought. Paul is writing language with a smooth flowing thought, but it stops being smooth when he sticks this word in. It's an adversative. It means, okay, I'm expecting a little turmoil here. Okay, I want you to notice it's here, and it's here. Now, in your English translations, you will not find 3 adversatives. They don't translate it as an adversative. The New American says, I've been crucified with Christ and it's no longer I who live. The translators translate does and. Well, they do that in the Greek a lot. I mean, there's 2,600 some odd uses of the in the New Testament and maybe 900 of them are and. But I have questions about whether that ought to be and anytime. This is an adversative. It means that you ought to have a bump in your thinking. Yeah, the thing's still moving. It's still moving forward. And it's still moving forward relatively easily. But there's some bumps on the bottom of this thing that are creating a little adverse reaction. We're going to talk about that. There's one here, and one here. Right now, all I'm trying to tell you is the translations don't give you that. And that means the translators have had a little problem trying to figure out what Paul was saying. And that's okay. They're human. They're not inspired. There is another problem right here. You see this little word that looks like it's a kind of a T, and then what? An N or something? That's a tau and an eta with an iota subscript. That iota subscript is actually a vowel. It's I vowel. But that eta is actually a long E-class vowel, and you pronounce that word te. But what that is a definite article. Well, definite article is the word the. We're going to the house. Indefinite article in English is a. We're going to a house. The is definite. This is a definite article. You see this word? It's got a tau in the front and then an omicron or an O and then a U kind of looking word. That's omicron upsilon. That's two. Guess what? That's exactly the same word as this. It's just in a different form because Greek puts the words together according to case issues. So you have a definite article here and a definite article here. Oh. When you're writing in on your computer, you know, and you say, okay, check this. If you write, we're going to the house, your grammatical checker jumps up and says, you've repeated yourself? You got two the's there? Well, Paul didn't run his grammar checker over this. The thing that's interesting about this is that this word, te, works backwards to this one, the word piste. It's the faith. This word, the, it's got the same ending as the word wiu, which is the word son. So this B goes with son. So he is saying, now I am living in the flesh by faith, but this goes with that, by the faith I am living. That is, of the Son of God. And what he's saying there is, I'm living by the faith of the Son of God. Now that's an interesting little... But we're not going to be able to get to that this evening. What I do want to get to is this issue that's involved in these little stones in the flow, these little adversatives that rock the boat. Let's take the first part of verse 20. Now, in the Greek text that I've translated or copied here, they put the phrase, I have been crucified with Christ, with verse 19. Why I don't have the foggiest? I don't know. Verse divisions are not inspired. There's no verse 19 and verse 20 in inspiration. It's just 19. That's part of the sentence that goes into 20 and 21 so on. The point that I'm trying to make, though, is in our text, in verse 20, it says, I have been crucified with Christ. In the Greek text, that's not here because it's in verse 19. But then it says, but I live. No longer I. Now, the translators said it in various ways. I have been crucified with Christ, and it's no longer I who live. That's kind of like, since I'm dead, I'm not living. That's that smooth-flowing, no interruption, no adversive idea that the New American Standard just dropped. King James, how's it read? I have been crucified together with Christ, but, what? Nevertheless, I live. So that's the contrary idea. I'm dead, but I'm alive. You see, we even say that name. I'm dead, but I'm alive. That does not flow easily. How can I have been crucified with Christ and still be living? It's not a smooth-flowing creek. It's, I've been put to death, but I'm still alive. And that makes a little bit of a in the mind of the reader. And that's what this means. There's a glitch coming, so just be aware of it. What Paul anticipated was that his declaration, I have been crucified together with Christ, was going to be a real problem for his readers because he was writing this letter and they knew good and well he was as alive as they were. How can you claim you're dead, Paul, when you're alive? And you know how he handled it? He said it this way, I have been crucified together with Christ. Period. I am living, but no longer as I. Now, I stuck the word as in there to make this flow, but I really believe that what he's saying is, yeah, I'm still living, but it's no longer as the I that was crucified. Okay, which I was crucified with Christ? When we think of the theology of the co-crucifixion of Paul with Jesus, who was crucified with Jesus in terms of Paul's reality? What was it in Paul that was put to death with Jesus? We call it the old sin nature. is that Adamic heritage that I think is the spirit of Paul that was actually crucified with Christ, so that Paul, as his spirit with Christ, died to the law. It was my crucifixion that put me to death to the law. So, yeah, I am alive, but no longer as the old I. There's a new reality here. So, the first glitch is, I have been crucified with Christ. I am alive, but no longer as I. Then the next one. But Christ is living in me. Greek doesn't put the words together the way we do in English. It puts them together in a different way. But this is the subject. Christ lives in me. But it's got this little glitch in it. But Christ lives in me. Now, what caused that glitch? He said, I've been put to death with Christ. I've been crucified together with Christ. I am alive, but no longer is I. But Christ is living in me. Now, what causes the glitch there? So he's answering the glitch that's raised by the no longer as I. Okay, then how is this working? Well, but Christ, who was also crucified, but we know he was raised together. I mean, he was raised on the third day. We know that. So Christ is dwelling in me. So that answers that glitch. And then he says, but the now, but the present or the now, I live in the flesh. Or, but presently, I'm now living in the flesh, but I live by the faith which is of the Son of God. So this third glitch, what caused that glitch? What is he talking about, but the now or the present living? Well, perhaps except that Christ is living in me. But I am living in me too. Okay? I mean, there is still an in-flesh reality where I'm there. It's not the old I, but there is an I that's there. Who is it? Well, it's me. In what form? Well, theologically, it's his soul. You see, when the old man's put to death, Christ is married to your soul. You are joined to a new man, new husband. This is Romans 7. When your old man that you were married to is soul and spirit, when the old man was put to death, then Christ took his place, joined himself to you as husband and wife, and then he began to produce children out of this union that is your behavior. So the new union is Christ with your soul, producing through your body new behavior. That's how it works. But the glitches are there. And I wanted you to understand this evening that the translator, I honestly don't think the translators understood what Paul's saying. I don't know if I do, but I'm pretty sure they didn't, because they didn't even deal with some of the translational issues here. They didn't render it faithfully. And the consequence of that is, we still don't know how you turn Jesus loose in your body so he can produce out of your body the right kind of behavior. See? And because they didn't know, they couldn't help us know. Now, we're about out of time, but I want to say this about Paul's unclear doctrinal declaration, and that is the lack of clarity on how you let the Spirit of Christ produce his life through your body so that the life of Jesus is seen through your body because the Spirit of Jesus is in your body. How does this possibility of remarkable thing, how do you let it go so that it happens? Well, I think that, first of all, if we will work our way through the text itself, we will be able, by the Spirit of God, to understand what Paul is saying. So that's what we're doing. I mean, but I had to spend a bunch of time this evening just making you aware that the translators dropped the ball here. So next week we'll come back and try to put together what Paul is saying. But I think that it's demonstrably true in terms of impact that the Spirit of Christ dwelling in a human's body, a believer's body, can produce some remarkable stuff if the engine of understanding is firing on all of its cylinders. If our understanding is, you know, got some clogged plugs, then the engine's going to run kind of rough. We may get down the road, but it'll be with lousy gas mileage and a lot of exhaust stuff and jerking and jumping and carrying on. And we'll say, well, that's my Christian life. You know, it's just jerking and jumping and carrying on. And just, but then I don't think it has to be that way. I think Paul's offering the possibility of remarkable things, but the engine of our understanding has to be hitting on all of its cylinders. So, in terms of the context and the text, Paul is demonstrating what's coming out of his body is the Spirit of Christ, because what's coming out of his body is a genuine love for not only Christ, but the Galatians, the Gentiles in Antioch, and Cephas in his error. In other words, Paul's love is covering the gamut. We know he's hitting on all cylinders and the Spirit of Christ is producing out of his body because his love for Christ, his love for the Galatians in writing this letter to them, his love for the Gentiles at Antioch, which stirred up this whole rat's nest in the first place in the beginning of chapter 2, and his love for Cephas in his error, all of those things are demonstrably right on target in this context. That's what Paul's demonstrating is his love. And that's the love of God. And it's not for himself. It's for them. And as a consequence, we can see the Spirit of Jesus producing the life of Jesus because the love of Jesus is being shown. And you can see it. It's happening with Christ and the Galatians and the Gentiles in Antioch and Cephas. And not only that, not only is his love being demonstrated as an expression of the love of Christ, but his faith as the overt root of his behavior is exactly on target. We have looked at the words of his description of what he believes here, and it's exactly right down the line, inerrant, on target. And when a person's faith is right on target, you're seeing the faith of Jesus being manifest. So, what was coming out of Paul's practice was his own teaching, and what he was coming out of his body was the life of Jesus. Demonstrably the life of Jesus. But it was not only the correctness of his words in expression that was true, it was also the actions toward which those words pointed that was true, and that meant the faith driving them was legitimate. Whenever you can see the love and the faith that's driving behavior, you see the person. And when the love is the love of Jesus and the faith is the faith of Jesus, you're seeing Jesus. It doesn't matter whose body you're seeing it out of. You're seeing him. And that's the point. Christ dwells in our bodies, and it is the Spirit of Christ who makes the life of Jesus manifest out of these bodies. And that's Paul's fundamental Christian life principle. I think the gospel's fundamental principle is verse 16. Where we believe in the faithfulness of Jesus, because it was the faithfulness of Jesus that qualified him to be our Redeemer. And because we believe in his faithfulness, we believe we have a Redeemer that's sufficient to satisfy the justice of God. That's verse 16. The faith of Christ produced a faithfulness that we then can believe in. And then we're justified when we believe in it. That's the gospel, verse 16. The Christian life is verse 20. That gospel introduced me to an indwelling presence of God in my body. And out of this body now, that person can be made manifest if the engine of my understanding is hitting on all the cylinders. Okay? So next week, we'll come back to the text and we'll wrestle with this issue of I'm living this life in my flesh now as a new I. I mean, I'm a soul now related to a new husband, Jesus. And out of my body is coming the production of righteousness, the children of righteousness. But how does it work? He says, by faith, that is, the faith of the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. We'll come back to that. besides that, except for that, do you have any comments or questions?